I'm Judy Adamus. I'm a community organizer and trainer. And for the last, I guess, what, 15 years, I've been training and organizing Biblical students, Torah students, and rabbis of all ilks. And so it's a pleasure to be here today. I want to recognize Rabbis Dave Baum and Annie Lewis and Andrew Sherman, and also Rabbi Heather, who learned about organizing when they were in at JTS, and now use it in the rabbinates along with about 350 other rabbinical students around the country. Let me just say it's a way of operating. It's not like, okay, there's this skill and that skill, and if I do these skills, if I learn these skills, then I'll be able to create a transformational culture where people feel like they have skin in the game in the show. And then I can just go do it. No, it's much bigger than that. But today, we're going to tackle one of those ways of operating through a tool called Hasidus. I want to just quickly, since there's a small amount of us, let's just quickly go around the room. I want you to tell me your name and your where you're at, actually, geographically.
Yeah, sorry, at it. Dave Pam, Booker, Tom.
Just as you took a nice bite.
My name is Dina Weber, Spain and Georgia.
Ruben Barkman, Spanish, Georgia.
Edith Lev, I work in Haifa, in Hadela, Israel.
Annie Lewis, I'm at Germantown Jewish Center in Philadelphia.
Mark Bounce, Virginia Beach, Virginia.
David Lerner, Lexington, Massachusetts.
Adrian Godfrey, São Paulo, Brazil.
Gideon Estes, Houston, Texas. I'm Randy Connors, right now geographically I'm here, but tonight I'll be in Birmingham, Alabama.
Mike Warbo, I'm currently in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and moving to Sarasota, Florida.
Michelle Solo, I live in Dallas, Texas.
Dallas, Texas, right here.
We've got the heart. I don't tell many people this, but I spent 6 years in Houston before I became Jewish. And it was a really interesting experience.
I'm Rabbi Andy Sugarman. I just moved from Miami to Brooklyn. For United States.
I'm Jan Hoffman. I'm living in New York City.
Many thanks to Jan for all the hard work she did right before she left and retired to make all this happen. You're saying who you are?
I'm Jan Hindensburg, I'm from Birmingham, Alabama.
Very nice. So you're connected to this film a little bit.
Yes, I am.
Carol Levithan, Jan passed the torch to me.
And she has been such a great person to work with. She's really made all this happen as well. I want to thank Rabbi Schoenfeld. Thank Rabbi Schoenfeld and the RA for allowing us to be part of this convention. It's in for recent opportunities with the executive committee and in the fall of JPS. Yes.
Okay. Alex Greenbaum.
Yes.
Pittsburgh, PA.
Okay. Nice spread of geography here. So,
and also,
I'm sorry.
I stuck that in Bernstein from Boynton Beach, Florida.
Great. Wow, really good spread. And you are?
Alicia Krauss from Virginia.
Building an ownership and transformation of culture in your synagogue or in your institution, where it happened to be, has everything to do with how you show up and how much of yourself you're willing to share with the people around you. Sharing your experiences and really soliciting that level of story and what makes people tick and where they come from and what's their particular talent that they love. These are all things that are part of building this kind of culture. And so, because we're doing a session on this culture, I'm going to tell you my story very briefly. And then, just so we can get a little bit more clear. All right, so very briefly, and Corey Davis heard the story from me. It doesn't change. So, I'm an organizer and a Jew for the same reasons, actually. I grew up Irish Catholic in South Bend, Indiana, working class. And when I tell you we didn't matter in South Bend. We came from the side of the tracks, and people didn't care what the poor white Catholics thought or did or what happened to them where I lived. So I grew up thinking I had absolutely zero agency. zero power. And that got reinforced by a couple of experiences. One experience was that my dad almost lost his job from the factory, and that was his best job, because it was, you know, at that time, a living wage, because of the intense level of grief on the part of the owner of that plant, even though he was making hand over foot profit. So a whole generation of men were about to lose their jobs, right, and their futures and their homes and everything else. And so that experience at 10 just made me feel like, wow, we really don't matter. People can do whatever they please to us, and you know, and nothing happens. So then when I was a little older, I was a victim of violence. And again, you know, there was no manhunt because we weren't important. My mother going to the police department and crying and saying, "You're not going to do anything? My daughter and several other girls got harmed. And we don't matter." And basically the police chief said, "Yeah, you don't matter. You're not important enough." So I was determined as a young woman not to be a victim anymore. So that's how I found organizing and organizing found me. And so for me, you know, everybody has kind of a feeling about why they think they're on the earth. And I think the Almighty put me here to make as much trouble as I could possibly make for people who want to do harm to other people, or want to exploit them, or want to whatever. So that's why I'm an organizer. Now, I'm a Jew also because of that, those experiences, right? But it was learning as a high school student at a Catholic school from an Indian priest, most Catholic too, about the prophets and the call to justice and the Almighty caring about the widow and the orphan. That message came to my ears and my heart. And it made me want to, wow, to be part of this religion. You know, that was a way of life. It wasn't something I did on Sunday. So I got attracted to Judaism, and I became Jewish some years later. And I'm celebrating actually 21 and a half years as a Jew. I'm so excited. I don't feel like I can wear a Star of David anymore. But the first 10 years, I looked so Irish, I felt like I had to like display my Yiddishkeit in a masterful way. And now it just kind of part of the way. Anyway, so those are some core experiences that made me who I am today. And so now you know a little bit about me. Now, I want to know what it is that, how do you try to interact, and how do you try to engage your members where you are, right? Based on who you are and what your vision for your synagogue is, how do you try to pull people in? How do you try to engage?
Well, I can start by saying I'm brand new in Birmingham. I've only been there 10 months. And I looked at my mission is to build relationships with people. So the first thing that I did was try to learn as many people's names.
Here we go.
And find out about their connections as much about them as I could.
Mm-hmm.
So I spend a lot of time talking to people.
Mm-hmm.
And letting them know that I know who they are.
Yep, there we go.
So that's kind of what I expected.
And how's that working?
Working wonderfully.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
Because, and why do you think it's working wonderfully? If you could put it over a second.
I think it's working wonderfully because people like to be known. But the thing that's working wonderfully for me is that it's a natural thing that I'm doing. It's not anything I have to try to do or work to do. It's totally authentic and real. That's what I love doing.
Right.
And I think they know that I love doing it.
Yeah, that's good. Well, yeah, it shows. Now, in the sort of culture that we're in America today, right, it's not naturally a culture where we get to know each other, or we try to meet each other in a very personal way, right? So, how do many synagogues communicate with their members?
Email,
right? Okay. Now, I have a BlackBerry. Okay. My daughter left, so I don't have an iPhone. Email is a great way to do what? What is email really meant for?
Information, right? Yeah.
A JTS student once tried to negotiate with me about the class that I was teaching, this crossover class, by email. That is not the way to negotiate. So in bold letters I put, turn off the freaking computer, pick up the phone, and call me. Okay?
It's disseminating information, right? When something's going to happen, what it is. Great, it's information, but it's not relationship, right? But we have confused the two. You know, when we want to know about a particular constituency within our synagogue, what does the culture tell us is a way to do that?
What do you want to know?
Check their Facebook page.
All right, Facebook. It's another way to disseminate, You can find out some information about people, but I would argue, and people argue back all the time, that it's not a relationship. Please don't tell me you think you have a relationship with somebody because you're Facebook friends, right?
Right. First you have to look at
it. Right.
Yeah. That's why I won't do a Skype training with people I've never met or don't have a relationship with. Because it's not the same thing as being in the room. Right? Demographic studies is often how we think that we're going to find out. Surveys. Ask them what they want and we'll give it to them. Right? So this culture here is all about relating to people as clients and customers. And therefore, we shouldn't be surprised when your congregants say, Rabbi, what am I getting for my dues? Gosh, those dues are high. And maybe they are. What have you done for me lately? Right? Well, I would argue you're not really engaging them. That's the question that they're asking. Wouldn't you rather have them say, which of the particular skills and talents that I have that you know now because you bothered to get to know me as a member, would be most useful for you to utilize at the shul? Isn't that what you'd want your congregants to say to you? But if you haven't taken the time to get to know who they are and what their struggles are, and where they came from, and what their foundational experiences have been, and what are their hopes and dreams for their children. If you don't know that, how can you possibly fully engage members? So, let me give you an example. Rabbi Ben Adler was in White Meadows, New Jersey. He's actually getting a new job. He's like of this generation. And Friday nights, they weren't getting encouragement for people for services. And everybody was wringing their hands about it. Rabbi, why don't we get more people on Friday night? Maybe we can change the liturgy. Maybe we can do something different. So what he said is, let's do house meetings. Let's do some small group conversations and ask people to share their prayer memories, their prayer story. When were times when they prayed really meaningful to them? So once you started hearing those stories, they were stories about, I don't know, how many of you here were around and active in the Soviet Jewry movement? I'm assuming some of you. Yeah, right? So remember getting on those buses, right? And the singing and the jobbing and so some people in the house meetings were talking about those experiences. An elderly woman was talking. She pulled out this really faded sheet of paper, which was from a Shiva booklet from when her husband died many years earlier. It was a special prayer. It wasn't in the prayer book, and she didn't know where it came from, but it was so beautiful. She kept it for like 30 years. So she pulls that out, right? Somebody else pulls out their bar mitzvah talk. So there were different experiences that people had that were meaningful, and they shared those, right? And so what they ended up doing is creating a scrapbook sitter in that show. People brought different memorabilia to put into that book. And they started using it like as an addendum to the sitter. So I can't begin to tell you how things changed for Rabbi Amar on Friday night. Just by the nature of asking people what their prayer stories were, changed the dynamic between he and them, right? And learning about each other more. So now it's like a booming thing on Friday nights over there now. let me give you another example. Rabbi Mishkan in Temple Beth Israel in Port Washington, he wanted to know what was going on with his unbelievers. A constituency that was a little bit less engaged, right? So we did some house meetings among the ministers. And one of them, who we hadn't talked to in a long time, said, you know what, I'm recently retired, my kids went away to college, I'm bored out of my mind, and I feel like I have all these things to give, and nobody ever gets me to do it. So guess what? Gail, she's now the president of Temple Beth Israel, right? So it's like you can find leaders that you didn't even know were there, or maybe haven't been engaged in 20 years, but are ripe for getting re-engaged if you figure out who they are, right? What are other ways that you've tried that maybe haven't worked in trying to engage members?
Meetings.
Give me an example.
Meeting in the show, just get ready, come in a certain time to just somebody comes here, nobody wants to be in charge.
So why do you think people don't come and don't want to be in charge? What are most meetings like?
Boring.
Right?
And very political, get a lot of trouble. Political and boring.
Right. So what would a meeting need to be to make people want to be there, change their schedule to be there, and want to be in charge?
Mission-driven.
Yeah.
You said fudge, and I said fun, and I think both of those are good.
But food always works, right?
Chocolate fountain.
What?
A chocolate fountain.
Chocolate fountain.
You get to dip every time you, bring something to the table.
Most meetings are boring or whatever. They go on for 3.5 hours because a lot of people don't know how to facilitate a meeting, as a one, right? It's a core basic skill that is, I guess, not taught in some venues. But, so nobody's clear about the goals, right? What's really going to come out of this? And there's no action steps so that people actually take responsibility. So that's why you have the chair of the committee always doing all the work, because we've gotten into this leadership mode where you can be on the board, you can be chair of a committee and not actually do anything. I'm working with a show in Little Neck. It's like a 45-member board, or maybe more than that, merging. And the rabbi and I are brainstorming about how do we get rid of half of this board? Because guess what? They don't do anything. So how do they get on a board if they don't do anything? What kind of message does that send? You get all the coverage and don't have to do any of the work. So, earned leadership, right? But the way it relates to what we're talking about is that you only know who to pitch for leadership, and it's a commitment, if you know who people are and what they can do and what their interests are, right? So house meetings are one way that we can do that. Dave, I want you to Rabbi Baum and Rabbi Konigsberg are just going to give a couple little short stories about ways that they've used these small group conversations.
So I wanted to tell a story about coming to my 5th-year anniversary being at my shul in Overton. I was ordained in 2009, so it was my first only pulpit, actually. And what's interesting was that my wife got an internship in South Florida, and I had to be there. There was like really only one shul hiring, so I really needed this job, and I also wanted this place. It was a place that I kind of always wanted. And we had a Saturday night Abdallah interview, and that was one of the things. And they put a bar stool in the middle of the room, and started, you're all there, right? They started, throwing questions at me and this and that. Now, there were some things I didn't know about this congregation, but there was one thing I did know, which was that one of the largest congregations in the Southeast is just 7 miles away from us. It's called Mayfair Congregation. Many of us are probably friends or friendly with the rabbis there. And this woman said, well, how are we going to compete with them? And I knew that at that moment she asked that this was going to be the question that would either get me the job or not get me the job. And I paused and I said, well, we're not. And her mouth dropped. And I said, we're not going to be what they are. We're never going to be what they are. If we want to be truly special and different, we have to be a relational place. What's a relational place? And I explained kind of what I learned. Now, I learned all this through working with Jeannie and the Cross Seminary course about a year and a half through doing my own organizing at JTS, actually. And I shared with them how we're going to do it. I said, we're going to have house meetings. We're going to do one-to-ones. They said, great, got the job. When I started, they said, Rabbi, I know that was nice. You really blew us away with that interview, but, we have no friends. So we'll do, some meet the rabbi meetings and that's it. And I said, okay. I did some training, actually, but I said, I talked with Gina about this, actually, at the time. I said, what do I do? So she guided me through it, and I sold this idea of one-to-ones. But really, it was the house meetings that transformed my work and the congregation. So I said, yeah, that's fine. Let's do meet the rabbi things. But I kind of switched. I said, we're going to call them house meetings. And actually, it's meet them. We're going to meet each other. And that's what they did. So we had around, by the end of our house meeting drive, we met 70% of the congregation came. And I didn't realize at the time how significant that was, because getting people out of their homes is not easy with their busy schedules. But they came, and they shared stories, and momentum built. Now, the amazing thing about is that what I didn't realize at the time is this were two congregations that merged together just the year before. And there was a lot of tension there. They did not truly feel that they were one. This actually brought them together, which I didn't even realize would happen. Why is that important? Because now, we haven't done house meetings in a couple of years. We're actually, my biggest critic was the vice president at the time, became the president, was with me at every house meeting, became my biggest supporter, asked me, when are we starting house meetings again? I didn't have to ask her, she asked me. So she's pushing me to do them. And it's important because it's changed the culture of the synagogue. They were welcoming, but now they really love each other. They want to bring other people in. We've grown from about 130, a soft 130 to now 187 families. And it's not because we built a preschool. They're not just members on paper. These are actually, I'm working harder than I've ever been before. I'm exhausted because they're people who want to be, they're busy. They want a piece of the institution. But it's important because the issue of are we one congregation is now we're in a lawsuit right now with Hadassah, Fort, and Bloomingdale Home for the Aged, who are challenging that our congregation has merged because we were left a gift. And our congregants are just beside themselves. They have no idea. How could they see that we're not one? And it's through these tools to get stories out there, to connect with each other, that we become one. And the work is not done. We're not perfect. We still have a lot of work to do. But I think that this tool, the methodology that I used here, was a great way, an amazing way, a transformative way to build a congregation.
David, at some point, will you or Gene actually talk about the agenda of what happens at
Yep.
us? We're going to model one.
We're going to model it, and then you can experience it yourself.
Yeah. That's what we're
going to do. I need to go 1:30, though. Don't be leaving early.
Yeah.
I'm serious.
Some of us have flights, so we're going to have to.
Yeah.
No, the same thing. We came and then they said to us, it's my first year. I've been going for about 10 months. And they said, well, how are we going to get to know you? And I said, well, we're going to do these meetings. We're going to do people's homes. They said, well, we don't have a good record for people coming to homes because people don't like to go to each other's homes. So I said, don't worry about it. I said, everybody, you just will get volunteers to open their homes and they'll invite their friends. I said, it'll just be their friends. right? And you don't have to worry about bringing stuff, you don't have to worry about being invited, or if they invite somebody back, right? Now, these are friends, so people just see each other anyway. So we get about 15, 20 people in the house, 10 couples or so, and some of them were single, some of them, just all kinds of different people who were their friends. We sit around the big circle, and they were ready to come and meet the rabbi. And I said, okay, what we're going to do is I want you to tell me, this is a 100-year-old congregation, everybody's supposed to know everybody already. You know, they're all all parts of each other's families and cousins with this one and that one. Small town in the south. And so I said, tell me either your best story of the synagogue, your best Bethel story, or your best Jewish story. And we went around the room. And at first it was kind of, the first people just weren't quite sure what to make of it. But it got into it very quickly. And before I knew it, they were getting to know me, I was getting to know them. And they were getting to know each other. After the first meeting, one of the people there said, this is the best thing I've ever been at. And nobody even asked me for money. Every time I had a house, somebody asked me for money. Nobody even asked me for money. This is the best thing I've ever been at. Everybody got to know each other. I mean, and these are people who already knew each other. Who went away saying, I never knew this about, my friends. And it just changed the whole dynamic, and people wanted to be involved. People wanted to know more. People wanted we knew us very, they got to know us very deeply, and we got to know them very deeply. And the few people who say, you've been here 10 months, you haven't met me yet. I said, well, why not? Where have you been hiding? Because we've had all these meetings. We only kind of stopped them, I guess, when you had your
certain. They want to start again.
Yeah, they wanted to make a work to start another round of them, probably.
I'm essentially yes to that story because by having people invite their friends and us in the community, yeah, it was really helpful to see who was friends with whom and which group was which group what. Because you might know, this one is a big philanthropist in the community, but it was interesting to see who their social group was as well.
Yeah.
Because it helped us to see not only relationships with them, mm-hmm, but what their relationships were with each other.
Right.
And when you're in a community that has a long history,
yeah,
you don't know how to find that information out.
Right.
But in an informal way, it enables us to know who people consider to be their friends.
Mm-hmm.
And that's been very helpful to us.
That's great. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll just mention, Randy was part of the first people I know,
October.
That's where he learned this art. We had 43 rabbis, I think.
Right.
So thank the Rabbinical Assembly for getting behind us and presenting.
So you know what? Before we go further, I want everybody to sign the silent sheet because I know that there are people trickling out. So I'm actually going to change the agenda. We're going to get into house meetings right after I just do a little setup instead of actually modeling. Okay, so that way you can experience it before you leave, whatever it is you're going to leave. Okay? So I want you to look at your handout. And a house meeting, we call it a house meeting, it's really a small group conversation that you can have anywhere, right? It's not a focus group. I don't know how I can say it more clearly. It's not a focus group. What happens in focus groups?
There's a focus.
So there's some sort of commercial agenda, or they want to sell a product or a service.
Right.
And they don't care about you as you. They care about you as
what about you?
A prototype is your hat.
How can you contribute to the end product as an
right.
you are?
Right. They're asking for your opinion. And the kind of ways we do house meetings, we're not asking for people's opinions about anything. We're asking for their experiences. And sometimes, if you're doing a visioning of the congregation's future, you can ask them for their hopes and dreams for this. But you always have a relational question as part of a house meeting because it builds the relationships and the ways that we're concerned about. So the purpose of a house meeting really is to build relationships among your members and with you, right? It's to identify new leaders. You always find new leaders. Just got to talk about Rabbi Mishkan, right? Found this current president out of this, right? People come out of the woodwork that you didn't even know about. And sometimes you can do a house meeting. You can do some targeted house meeting. Let me give you an example. In Reconstruction Synagogue of the North Shore in Manhasset, we wanted to know what seniors were struggling with there. And so we did targeted house meetings with seniors. And out of that came an organization-wide initiative to change how home health care is delivered on Long Island. And now a bunch of low-wage, previously low-wage, immigrant women of color, largely Jamaican, Haitian, Nigeria, now have decent jobs, great training and supervision, and they're taking care of a lot of the seniors that we have on Long Island and some of our synagogues and churches. And that all came out of a house meeting. It's crazy to think of what can come out of a house meeting, right? You listen to people's stories, and then sometimes it leads to particular kinds of action, right? A new mission for the synagogue, or vision for the synagogue, or it could a whole bunch of new programming could come out of it. Definitely new leaders. So we build relationships, we share stories and experiences, we understand each other. We potentially come up with a common vision or patterns of interests and struggles. It kind of depends on what the purpose is. And sometimes it leads to very specific actions. What it's not is to collect data, right, like you do in a focus group. It's not to declare opinions and ideologies. This isn't the forum for that. You're not reacting and arguing in these house meetings, right? It's people's experiences. You can't argue with their experiences. And it's not to complain or to chit-chat. So it has a very specific purpose. It usually lasts about an hour. And so what we're going to do is experience one. So how many people? Two, four. Okay. So Andy's gonna lead that house meeting. Andy's gonna lead this house meeting. And
yeah, we'll take a look.
Huh?
Like 7 people.
So maybe one person from each of those groups could come over here. You want to come over to this group? One of you from there, come to this group. David, will be this one.
Yeah.
All right? Okay. And so I'm just going to run through the agenda for a typical house meeting, which we don't have time for. We're going to do like a piece of the house meeting. If you look at page 2 of the handout, it has basically what the basic agenda of the house meeting is, right? So it's like, you're opening, you're welcoming people, you're explaining why you're doing these house meetings. There's a Devar Torah. And then, you know, you go around in a group and you ask, we call them rounds questions, right? You ask one question and everybody answers it and you give them a specific amount of time. So each of you can have up to 2 minutes as you go around and tell this story. You don't have to use the whole 2 minutes.
What are the ground rules?
The ground rules are that you don't interrupt each other when you're telling, you know, your story. You're not going to argue with anybody. You're going to listen very carefully and attentively to what everybody else has to say and save your questions for the end because you always have time for discussion where people can engage each other afterwards, right? Maybe your story or somebody said a story that really resonated with you and you wanted to ask them about it. And then you have a piece around next steps at the end. So there's just a bare bones agenda here. And I'll put my email and phone number up after this. And if you want more specific materials or information or you want to call me, please feel free to do that. I'm happy to talk to you some more. So here's the question that we want you to answer in this house meeting. Share an experience of what keeps you going as a rabbi. So we're not looking for, the bar for the Bnei Mitzvah, kids keep me going. No. Share an experience that illustrates what keeps you going as a rabbi.
What if somebody's a spouse?
What if something they keep you going as a rabbi?
There are a few spouses.
Keep you going as a rabbi.
So you know what your question would be, and you're not rabbis, right?
Neither of us are.
Neither of you are rabbis. I actually thought you were a rabbi. I don't know that. Okay. So how about this question for you? What keeps you going as a leader? Right? Because clearly you're a leader. Right? You wouldn't do this. I'm assuming this is just a junket that you come with your spouse, right? So what keeps you going as a leader in your synagogue? Okay? So we're going to take about, 10 minutes? Two, four, six, yeah.
One of the things that I did, we're all very attached to our devices, and one of the things I tell is to, at our house meetings, as I said, put our phones in a basket, and the only phone I have is this one, and it's the timer. So if we could just for the duration of this meeting, just put our computers and iPads away, just close them, and you can put your phones in the center, give you some freedom there. So that's actually, we're going to have to ask you that to be a part of these sessions. Okay.
So I'm
sorry. We're going to take 20 minutes, and you're going to have time to react to each other afterwards.
So it's 10 minutes of storytelling, and then 10 minutes of discussion where you pick out what moved you from one story, what were similarities, so on and so forth. So that's 10 minutes. Okay. All right. Great.
So I'll have key times, when the timer is off.
And JT, if you didn't do this, we'd have to stop
watching. Sentence.
Be like,
it's fine.
You're lying out there, and it's kind of awkward. So I said,
the closer the meeting, you say to the just okay. On and 2 minutes of the story.
And then
share the experience that
you need to share that we're doing with each other. So thank you all for coming.
The rabbi is going to be here.
And we're going to shape my life. Discussion, share experience as well.
You make the venue, you come.
Very passionate.
He gives us 5% discount.
And
anyone who's in this room gives 5%
our CEO.
So he gives back. So we said we get 100 days. I got my first email today. It's moments like that.
I'm going to go ahead and go here. 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 I'
And she'll check in with me. She'll say, how follow you two, but
you had one.
Now she's got all these shirts. I don't know when she's going to
open it. No.
But I'll be like, I'm doing well, but tell me about you. How's your granddaughter doing? How are the kids doing? Are you taking care of yourself? Is there rest? Like, are the nurses coming so that you have some rest? Like, I don't know if they're here or something. And I'll do something for you, self-care. And I'm a great believer in self-care. I don't know what solo is, but I will speak very highly that it's the most important thing to think about is yourself. You've got to take care of yourself, because especially when you're a caregiver, not take care of yourself means you're not going to be able to take care of anyone else.
Is there one specific experience that comes to mind about all of those procedures? A person who inspired me to become a rabbi in my college said that every job he had, he thought he would have done for free. We had a society where you don't need to get paid. My role as a fundraising rabbi. We all need to get funded. We all build these projects, the monster projects. Our synagogues, our salaries need to come up. The kinds of listening I do, the relationships I helped build, first for JTS, but it's been 4 years now. And I still remember the first time, I was given an opportunity to pay for a kind of education together, to get an education.
To be able to
conversation that we have been able to come to
Gideon's story.
And the transition is also about your story about taking people here to every time you get whatever says every day, you get all these
arguments. I'm going to sign a petition here, and they're like, well,
change
that
role from a group of women organization, and then start with a picture.
one-to-one, where you actually sit down with somebody for 40 minutes and share each other's stories and build a relationship. In small group conversations, we do have note takers. Because often we're looking for some direction out of these house meetings. Sometimes they're just straight out for relationship building, you're doing that for that purpose too. But sometimes, you want to find out some things, right? And that there's some patterns of things that you want to know about. Or, like, you want to capture if someone said something very specific about what they love doing that comes out of it. You want to make sure you engage them around, right? So note takers are key. And now that I have your emails, I will email you. We have, like, a note takers form. And just, you know, that kind of thing might be helpful to you.
I was thinking about it with a meeting that Randy and I did.
Yeah.
And I said to people, I'm going to write things down because we're meeting a lot of people that I need to remember.
Yes.
And I was curious. I wanted to know who was related to who and
right.
what she was and how long they were in the congregation and where they came from. So I said, I'm not going to write down exactly what you're saying, but just key things because it's going to help me and Randy, Rabbi, to remember, you know. And anecdotally, recently we were at an event and I met some people whose name had come up previously, and because I wrote it down, I remember who they were related to. And it enabled me to engage in a more meaningful conversation in a cocktail hour rather than that garbage.
But can I tell you that it's more than just that which is yeah, because there's a program, a computer program that can do that actually. There's something up here. It's about writing down stories, key moments.
Yeah, that's so that's what I was saying. I was writing down something specific about a family that enabled me to have a conversation with these people who I didn't connect to hard. And I wouldn't have had if I hadn't been at this other place.
So it's great. So you capture certain kinds of things that you think are going to be helpful to you, right?
Yes.
There's one. There's one person who's designated as the note, like a note taker.
Okay.
Yeah, and usually you get somebody else as a timekeeper, so you as a facilitator don't have to worry about that, right? We're not really have time to go into techniques to shut people up, but these little phone things are pretty good though, right? I mean,
it's pretty good.
But you know, you just use your judgment. You know, it's like you don't want to say, "Okay, your time is up." Because that's too relational, right? But you can say something like, "Who are you, Gideon?"
Gideon.
So Gideon's talking, and he's over his time, and he's talking past the thing, and so I say to Gideon, thank you so much for sharing. You know, I'm conscious of that Dave is chomping at the bit to tell his story. We don't want to take away from Dave's time, right? So then you kind of use the next person as an excuse to get them to stop talking, right? So you're saying, well, who can I do these house meetings with? What venues? So, you know, you can do it to vision. You know, I think your first ones, right, were around visioning. Yeah. What kind of show you want to be? Yeah. Oh, here's a great question. We used this at Sheriff Fins around the city some years ago. It's not if you had a magic wand, what would you create? Because what does that what does that denote?
Money,
or somebody else is going to do it. I'm just going to wave my little wand, and somebody else is going to do all the work. No, if you were the magic wand, what would you create? Right, that animates your imagination. You'd actually invest some time and resources to make happen. Right. That's a very different question. So how you ask the question is really important, right? So you don't say a question like, what do you want what can we do here at the Shoal to make it a place that you want to run to? No. Again, it denotes somebody else doing the work. How do you want to, what talents do you want to bring to the table to help build and grow and strengthen this Shoal of North? That's a very different question, right? It's this thing called the iron rule we have in organizing, which is don't do for others what they can do for themselves. It's not the golden rule, and it's not the rule that says DAFCA do everything for everybody like they were a client or a customer so that they'll come back. No, it's not that. It's the opposite of that. If you challenge people to bring their full selves to this place that you all love, that this place is not going to go into the future unless they're at the center of it, right? It's like getting across the idea that the newest person in the room is as important to shaping the future of this place as the founders were. Think of that concept. Then everybody feels skin in the game. Because if you don't feel skin in the game, you're not going to grow, you're not going to be there for the future. The Road of Shalom. We transformed it's in Manhattan, it's a big place. We transformed very boring, like everybody else has boring, parent, teacher, you know those like orientations that you do for religious school families that everybody comes to and they hate it and they leave halfway through. So we decided we weren't going to do that anymore over there. And we were going to just be really much more fun than that. So we turned that orientation into house meetings. So all these parents were doing house meetings with each other and they were telling the story about what was the best and the worst part of their opening this experience, and what was their greatest hope for their child. What kind of experience did they want their child to have? They have uncovered unbelievable stories. I can't begin to tell you. And for the gay room in the room, we asked, what was your foundational coming of age story? You know what I mean? And
they felt part of it too. It was really great. So, you know, you could do it with religious school parents at Temple Israel Center in Westchester. We did house meetings with new members, like people that joined in the prior 5 years. They wanted to get some stories about what would engage them more fully. And so now several of them are engaged, doing all different kinds of stuff because we found out what their interests were. We found out what their talents were. Why did they choose Temple Israel Center? Right? So, one more story. In covering invisible constituencies. So, again, I've heard of. We found an invisible set of parents who had autistic children who were not engaging in the shul, even though their religious school had a track for autistic children. I mean, they were thinking about this, you know, but these families were not bringing their kids to services because they were afraid the kids were going to be loud or didn't act out. You know what I mean? So they increased. So they did one-to-ones in house meetings and found like 80 parents, right, of autistic children in that shul, which was shocking to them because they thought they knew all of them. They created a whole, they brought in this educational, this autistic educational expert, and they created a religious service for the hugging that was tailored to autistic children and young adults. And it was phenomenal. So these families, you can imagine how deeply involved they feel now, and how loyal they feel to the show, because their deepest concern was addressed, right? Their children and their young adults feeling part of their community. So those are just some examples. There's a lot of things that you can do. I don't know if anybody else has used them in the room that wants to share any. Anybody else doing any yet? House meetings?
Yeah, go ahead. I did a house meeting. We were trying to reinvent our junior congregation. And so I had a group of parents involved in had them share experiences in prayer that were meaningful or moving for them, so it was powerful. But they all just got to know each other better, and it led into a conversation about what they wanted for their children and how to pass those things on, and led to some changes in the program.
Mm-hmm. Great. So, you know, you look at what the patterns are, you look at what comes out of the house meetings, and then you figure out who are some potential new leaders that, let's say there's a pattern around, like you just said, right, that was it young families, young...
Or junior congregation.
Junior congregation. Yeah. So then you figure out who was most interested in that, right, out of those house meetings. And then they set up maybe a little action team, right? We call it action team because nobody wants to join the committee. And we still have meetings, but maybe you can call something else. Action team gatherings, I don't know. But Then you start working on how do you take the idea that came out of a house meeting and then actually put it into action. So,
One other thing that's really important about that action team committee difference. It's not really semantics, but our colleague Noah Farkas has really done this very well at Valley Beth Shalom, which calls Very Big Shul. In California. But they don't have committees. They don't have standing committees. They have action teams that whose lifetime is at most, 3 to 5 months? And then that's it. And then the leaders of these teams are thanked and invited to join a new set of house meetings on issues in the community. But the committees are there. There's no sense of we have to go to that committee meeting tonight because that's what we always do on Tuesday nights. When the problem is addressed, it's researched and then acted upon. Mm-hmm. Once the immediate goal is reached, you start over.
Mm-hmm. Isn't that beautiful? So it's like you don't have standing. I mean, there's something you have to have a finance. Oh, so there's certain things you have to have, but everything else, you know, often we create that. You know, a committee got created 30 years ago, you know, 3 rabbis ago, nobody wants to kill it because God forbid the rabbi's going to come back from his grave and shake his fist. No, it's like the work, it's really what they do. It's like the work is around people's passion.
Yes.
Right? Thank you for reminding me.
Yeah.
Yes.
It's not, you know, it doesn't just drag on for the sake of dragging on.
Yes.
So people's time is really valued.
Correct. Exactly. And Jeffrey Abraham, too, who just was in... and now he's going to be in San Antonio, deep in the heart of Texas. Building a new network of rabbis there. But he did, out of house meetings there, they created a new school. They created a religious school, didn't they?
Nursery.
There,
Watermelon Wednesdays, which he talked about yesterday.
Right. So, you know, the possibilities are endless, can I tell you, right? So I want to, we'll wrap up. I know people are anxious to get to the airport and going on that, but I want to close with an oratorio. And you know Rabbi Jonathan Sacks, right?
Okay.
How old are you? Anyway, he has this thing in his book, To Heal a Fractured World, that just moves me to the core of the show. So, B'nai Israel, right? We're coming out of the desert. No, we're in the desert. We're coming out of slavery. And you would think that that experience of being, you know, Almighty's hand is reaching in and taking us out of this terrible situation, that we would want to be faithful forever. The course of our lives, right? No more idolatry. But of course, then what happens? right? We saw a loose heart out there in the hot, beating sun. And, you know, we made the golden calf. And so his point was, look, we were not transformed, Dafka, interestingly enough, by being taken out of slavery in Egypt, by the signs and wonders of the Almighty. You'd think that would be enough, but it wasn't. Because it's what we got from somebody else, the Almighty, in this case. We didn't have to work for it, right? So Sachs says it's only when we had to take our time and talents, right? The gold jewelry from the women, the craftsmanship of the wood by the men, it created the mission. Only after we created the Mishkan out of our stuff to make a home for the Almighty, that's when we didn't commit idolatry for generations. And he claims it's because we're transformed by what we do, not by what we get. And I just think that's
like a Torah of organizing, you know what I mean?
It's like an iron rule, right?
I don't think you knew it when you did it.
But it's, I guess that's what I want to leave you with. You know, it's like, let's engage people out of who they are, not just what we do. You know, not just a bunch of tasks we have to get done. But let's get to know them so we can know how to engage them and how to be absolutely a tool that we have. So I just want to go around the room and say one more how you're feeling right now. Rabbi Sugarman.
Energized. Really inspired for the end of on a high at the end of this conference.
And he happens to be brother of one of my best friends. Dad, in New York. How do you like that?
Contemplative.
Leaving wanting more.
Good.
Yes. Good.
Too short. It's too short.
So listen, I'm going to give you my name and my phone number. I ran out of cards. So call me anytime if you want to brainstorm some things or you want to learn when we're going to do more training or whatever.
You mentioned the October.
Yes, October, is it 27th and 28th? Something like that.
That was what was last year. It was the 20th and the 29th. But we don't. The dates are still in flux, but we're planning to do a training in L.A. And so that everybody west of whatever that river is in the middle of the country. It's in New York. It'll be for everybody.
Is there anything outside of New York?
Sorry?
New York is the whole country.
Yeah.
We'll have to get back to you.
But it's October, and you'll get the date soon. It's I think it's the third week in October. We didn't settle on the exact dates yet. We've got to talk to the folks at the UJ, but it's going to happen.
Is it going to be like a clergy 2.0?
Yes, essentially that. It may involve students. That's up to them.
Correct.
But,
okay.
So it's jappelman@joinforjustice.org. Clearly, I missed the handwriting class when I was doing this. 375-9150. Thank you.
Thank you.